Hello and welcome back to another episode of the HRER podcast, where we delve into the world of HR emergencies and scandals. Don't forget to follow and subscribe to HRER on your favourite podcast platform.
Get ready for scandalous stories, lessons learned, and a generous dose of advice for HR professionals for navigating the HR landscape.
Our goal here is not just to entertain, but also to help you learn from the topics we touch on in order to save your business from its own emergency.
We're about to onboard a new chef. However, they've now stated they'll only work for us if classified as self-employed to avoid paying tax. What are our options and what are the risks?
We've got the control test. How much control do we have over this individual? Are we going to expect them to follow our rules, our policies, our procedures, and our ways of working? And these are the things that we need to be thinking about when we're deciding if someone's an employee, a worker, or a self-employed person. So these days, tribunals, you're looking at 10 to 15 grand plus VAT. So really all in, so between your holiday pay, potentially your national minimum wage claim, your basic award, your compensation, 30, 40 grand.
Just before we start, protect your business from the risk of tribunal, reduce legal costs, and save yourself from HR headaches with our Heroes software and employment law consultancy services.
I don't know what number episode this is, but we're back in the...
We're past the numbering, Ollie. We're such a highly successful top 20 HR podcast.
We are.
We don't need to number them anymore.
What are we, number 18 or 16 at the minute? One or two?
Yeah, well, we keep fluctuating between the two.
Every time I check, it's 16 or 18.
Every time I check, we have a drop out the top 20 and then pop back in really quickly. So I don't know if I jinx it.
I don't know. Are we climbing these rankings? But we'll just persevere. Right?
And we don't pay for our ranking.
No.
That is purely organic.
Is that a dig at someone who does?
Everyone who's above us.
Yeah.
Pretty sure they all pay for it.
So. Yeah. Pay to win merchants.
Anyway.
Anyway. We've got a story today about a chef who won't pay tax. Can you believe it? Let's start. Hi Alyssa, thanks for introducing us to your HR system. We're about to onboard a new chef using your fast and reliable right to work checks. Shout out Trust ID. However, they've now stated they'll only work for us if classified as self-employed to avoid paying tax. What are our options and what are the risks?
So, from a software perspective, you can answer that question.
Can I?
Yeah, if they want to onboard someone as a contractor. Forget the legal, yes or no. As a contractor?
It's a lot less data. Yeah, you don't know.
We can do it.
We can do it, yeah.
There we go.
We got
there eventually. Yeah. I had to handhold you.
I was saying this
to you yesterday.
This
is why you're not in sales, Ollie. It's less data.
Oh, I just forget, don't I? We were speaking about this yesterday as well.
Yeah.
I was like, I can bring that up. And you've had to prompt me to do it. We can accommodate contractors and employees.
Yeah, we can.
We do both. Like, not a lot of HR systems do that.
No.
But we do.
And the reason being is because our workforces are diverse. But we're going to dive into just how diverse a workforce can be outside of, you know, the normal stuff that we talk about, which is discrimination, Equality Act, protected characteristics. We're talking about a whole other kind of categories of people that are working for us. So in this situation, can we do this? So that is going to be probably what we're going to talk about for the next half hour is, do we just get to choose our status? I am choosing to be self-employed because... my perception is it's more tax efficient.
Mm-hmm.
And this is actually something that particularly in the hospitality industry, we see a huge amount of around things like chefing roles, which can be quite difficult to fill, where the person who is being recruited into that role often has the power in the situation. They may well be dictating salary. They may well be dictating benefits. Or like in this situation where we have a chef who says, either you onboard me as a self-employed individual or I am not going to work for you.
Wow.
He was that categoric about it. There was no negotiation.
It sounds like this chap's coming from a real perspective of privilege. Like he had the choice of sort of many places to work.
Potentially, yes.
Right.
And it's not wholly uncommon. It's a query that I probably get once a week. Okay. Where a client will ring and say, we want to onboard somebody, but they are saying that they want to be self-employed. Or they will go elsewhere. And particularly in a time when it can be difficult to recruit, it can be difficult to find good people, the temptation often is just to agree. And we're going to come on to why that exposes us to a whole can of worms.
Could be a good or a bad idea. Let's start with the HR perspective. What responsibilities do employers have when employees insist on working off the books without proper documentation?
The responsibility for the employer is to decide what that person's employment status is. It is not down to the individual to say, I am now self-employed. I'm not going to be an employee.
It's not
today.
Up to them, is it?
It's not up to them. Technically, it's also not actually up to HR. It's up to the law. Mm-hmm. So the law will establish what someone's status is, and that is done by looking at what that working relationship is. So it is a myth that if I were to give you a self-employed contract and you sign it, that because we are under contract for you to be self-employed, that there we go, all the legal nonsense is sorted out. We have a contract that says that that person's self-employed. All the judge is going to do is look at that and say, very good, now let's actually look at what goes on day to day.
They're just not bothered.
They're not. The contract might, depending on the situation, might have some influence, but only if the realities of the situation reflect what the contract says.
In my head, if someone's self-employed, the employer is off the hook as such.
For lots of stuff. So we've got three types of employment status, or three ways of engaging people in the UK to work for your business. We have employees, the gold standard. So they get the benefits, they get all the rights, they get all the wonderful things that employees expect to get when they are working for someone. We then have workers, which is this weird kind of grey area in the middle. And then we have self-employed. They are not employees. They work for their own business and they are contracting with clients. Right. So this is not an employer-employee relationship. It's a client or customer and engaging company relationship, which is
worker,
very different.
Then?
So the worker, as I say, is the weird bit in the middle.
Right.
It's something that we're likely to see get removed under current government. It's something that's been talked about extensively because it's seen as generally a bit of a pain. Because okay. Employment status isn't necessarily black and white. There are various tests, there's various questions that we ask to establish what somebody is. Now, a worker is someone who you might have working for you on a casual basis. That doesn't mean you just pay them cash, which is what lots of people tend to think, is they think it's casual worker. They work a day and I give them a bit of cash at the end of the day because it's casual work. That's not what we mean. What we mean by casual is that they're not contracted to work 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. It might be, oh, Ollie, I've got a bit of work on next week. Can you come in and do 4 hours for me? And then you might not hear from me for 3 weeks.
Okay.
You could say, actually, Alyssa, really sorry, mate. I've got something else on next week. Thanks for the offer, though. So I have no obligation to offer you work.
Right.
And if I do offer it, you've got no obligation to take it.
Right.
So it's a much more kind of free environment.
Loose, isn't it? It's loose.
So I can choose whether to offer you work, you can choose whether or not to take it. If I were, say, to offer you a week's work, say, right, Ollie, I've got a week's work for you next week, you go, yep, great, I'll be there on Monday. If halfway through the week you go, actually, I can't finish the week out, that's different. We've contracted for you to complete a course of work, you would be expected to finish it.
In that situation, what's the contract? Is it just me saying, yeah?
Ideally, we should have either a freelancer agreement in place, okay. Perhaps a 0 hours contract.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So this is the kind of realm that we're talking about here. So when we talk about workers, often we are talking about things like freelancers, 0 hours workers. We might just have a worker contract. Okay. And these can be very, very simple. They don't need to be very long. One of the templates that we provide, I think, is only a page and a half long.
Okay.
So really, really simple, just kind of covers off the key elements. Now, the difference with an employee is I am obligated to provide you with work. So I've taken you on as an employee. If you are an employee, I can't say to you tomorrow, I haven't got anything for you to do, mate, tomorrow, so don't come in, I'm not going to pay you.
Imagine.
Imagine. And that's how ridiculous it is with that status to think, mm-hmm. Well, of course you have to provide me with work because
I work here. Yeah, of course.
Equally, I provide you with work. You can't ring me up and go, I've got something else on today. I'm not in it today.
Crazy.
Unless you book annual leave or you're off sick, you are obligated to do the work. So this, we call it mutuality of obligation. It's quite a complex legal principle that we've just broken down there. Mm-hmm. Employees and employers, there is mutuality of obligation. I am obligated to provide you with work. Mutually, you are obligated to do it. For workers, we don't. I can offer you work, you can take it or leave it. The self-employed are more removed again. So there's no control really in this situation. So as a worker, I can control how you do the work. So I can say, I expect you to turn up and wear our uniform. Mm-hmm. I expect you to represent yourself as being part of the company. And say if it was the chef situation, I expect you to dice the vegetables in this way. I expect you to plate the food up so it looks like this. And I expect the chicken to be cooked in this manner. If I'm self-employed and you're exhibiting me to that level of control, I'm not in control of my own work. If you were to bring in someone who's self-employed, they're probably going to wear their own uniform. They are going to do the work how they see fit.
Right.
Because you're bringing in that experience. Hmm. So a really common industry, so say, for example, you want to have your house painted and you bring in a decorator to paint your home. Mm-hmm. You might say, I want these colours, I want this wallpaper, and I want these rooms doing. But are you going to go in and micromanage him and go, I don't like your the edging's not right, don't do it that way?
Absolutely not. No.
He's self-employed. He's going to do his work the way he wants to do it. So we've got mutuality of obligation, and then we've got the control test. How much control do we have over this individual? Are we going to expect them to follow our rules, our policies, our procedures, and our ways of working? Am I going to dictate how that work is done? Is there going to be a line manager? Is there going to be a supervisor? Are they answering to anybody? And these are the things that we need to be thinking about when we're deciding if someone's an employee, a worker, or a self-employed person. And if a self-employed person fails those tests, they are going to be considered a deemed employee. And that has a lot of risk for an employer. So if you had someone, for example, who has worked for you as a self-employed person for 2 years, and you fall out with them, and you go, you know what, you're self-employed, on your way. We're no longer going to engage you. You're self-employed, I don't have to give you any notice, I can just bring the contract to an end. That person gets the hump. They go to see a solicitor and say, this contract's been ended, all my income's gone. Right, clever lawyer, tell me what I can do about it. Clever lawyer is going to look at the contract and go, yeah, okay, says you're self-employed, but let's talk about day-to-day what was happening with you. You had a line manager. You wore their uniform. You were driving their company vans. You used their insurance, their tools. You were told how to do your work, in what order, what quality was expected. You had no control over your hours or how you worked. You, mate, were an employee.
By, not by definition, but by like...
By the legal test.
Okay.
Which means you are owed 2 years of holiday pay.
Regardless of what the contract says.
Regardless of what the contract
says. Oh, wow, okay.
It means you're owed 2 years of holiday pay.
Wow, okay.
It also means on the weeks when perhaps that person has done lots of hours.
Overtime.
And they were paid a weekly fee or a daily rate. Mm-hmm. If that average means they've dropped below the minimum wage, there is a minimum wage claim.
Okay.
And also, because they've worked there for 2 years, an unfair dismissal claim. Because they haven't been dismissed through a procedure. They haven't been dismissed for a fair reason. And all of this can land on that employer's desk. And the big one is often that holiday pay liability.
Is it not quite rare for someone who's a self-employed contractor to work for over 2 years, though?
Yeah, they can. Yeah, on an ongoing basis, in some industries in particular, it's not unusual for people to be on long-term contracts. Now, even if there's people listening who think, oh, well, you know, I only use my self-employed contractors for a few weeks here and there. Remember, the employment rights bill's coming. We're going to have day one rights, which means that someone won't have to work somewhere for 2 years to be able to bring an unfair dismissal claim. So if we get our status wrong, there could be a huge influx of these claims because people will have got that status test wrong. And it's such an area of massive risk. So when someone says, oh, well, do you know what? I'll just let the guy work the summer. I need a chef. If it all goes wrong, well, he's self-employed, we've got no risk. That is, it's just not true. It's one of the biggest myths. And if someone's wanting to do it for tax evasion purposes, it's something that really gets my goat. Everybody has to pay tax.
Yes.
What makes you so damn special to think that you're going to just try and bend the rules to suit your own situation when everybody else has to do it? And what message does it send to the rest of your workforce?
Especially if they're not contractors.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And they're just they're going by and by and paying normal tax rate. That's what they're trying to essentially swindle the system, aren't they?
Yeah, they
These
are.
People.
Yeah.
What's the sort of cost for businesses getting this kind of thing wrong? What are we looking at?
So when it comes to holiday pay, that accrues at a rate of 12.07%. So just over 12% of their earnings, the time that they've been with you, you would owe them in a holiday pay claim as a starting point. if you have dismissed them without a process, or they have resigned and they're going to claim constructive dismissal, you'd be looking at the equivalent of a redundancy payment and then a compensation payment that could be up to 52 weeks loss of earnings.
Oh.
So heck, yeah. These aren't cheap. And then your fees to pay your legal team. So these days, tribunals, you're looking at 10 to 15 grand plus VAT. So really all in, so between your holiday pay, potentially your national minimum wage claim, your basic award, your compensation, 30, 40 grand.
God, a lot to think about, isn't there?
Yeah.
There I is. Thought it was just a tax thing.
And then, because you haven't been deducting PAYE, HMRC are going to come for you.
Which is another kettle of fish,
which
isn't
is
it?
Another kettle of fish.
And what if they look under the bonnet and there's more?
And there's more of them.
Yes.
And then you've got a historic PAYE liability. It can be never-ending. So now, Mikey. The argument over who's responsible for the PAYE, whether it's the self-employed worker or the company, we're not accountants.
Mm-hmm.
However, does anybody want HMRC sniffing around the business?
No.
No, you don't.
No.
You don't want it. So in terms of that, the risk for one person who comes to you and says, I will not work for you or else, is it really worth the risk?
I don't like the whole being like, in that situation, I wouldn't like being held at gunpoint as a business owner anyway.
No.
I'd tell them to sling the
to
rock.
Do one, basically.
Yeah,
do
nice
one.
Way, yeah.
Go and work for somebody else who's prepared to take on the legal risk.
Yeah.
And you've also got to think as well, if you've got employee liability insurance, so insurance for your business that covers you for employment claims, if you've misclassified somebody knowing that it might be wrong, there's potential that your insurance won't cover you. So you could be covering this privately.
Could it be like a form of fraud? I love that. I mean, I'm
not. Yeah, I'm not a criminal lawyer, but if you are knowingly
person, misleading, yeah,
if you know
types.
That they're that they are really an employee, arguably there could be some sort of tax evasion or fraud offence. I don't know. I'm not a criminal lawyer. It might be something when we look at our guest series and we get some other legal specialists on to talk about this sort of thing. But it's not worth the risk.
No.
And it's
that's
just
the message here, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I do like to talk about fraud a lot, so it would be good to get a criminal
You do,
lawyer.
I think you've mentioned it a few times.
It's an easy sort of word to chuck out there, isn't it? And it carries a lot of gravity as well. Like, it's just people are lying about stuff and they can get fined for it.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. Employee perspective now. It's the only way I can guarantee work in industries like hospitality. What are my options, essentially, if it's just seasonal work?
So, depending on the type of role, we've got to think of that test again. Mm-hmm. So you sometimes, when the boot's on the other foot, you'll get employers who will say, we only take on self-employed. And they will tell you, here is your self-employed agreement. And they will write your invoice for you every week. And
that
say,
saves you a job, doesn't it, I suppose, as a contractor?
Well, not really. It's not the best practice for your employer to be writing your invoices for you.
Right.
And they're doing it to reduce their national insurance and PAYE bill. Because it's expensive to employ employees. You've got to make those pension contributions. You've got to pay sick pay. You've got to pay holiday pay. You've got to pay maternity pay. You've got notice obligations. There's a whole raft of reasons why employing employees and workers is expensive. So you do get some rogue employers who refuse to payroll anybody and they tell everyone that they are self-employed. If you're an individual and you think, well, I've got no other option, I can't get any work, you've still got to be mindful that in terms of the obligations around tax that you might need to take some advice from an accountant, because what you don't want is to land yourself with a tax bill because you've been forced into a situation by a rogue employer. So it's not for me to tell somebody who's desperate for work and needs to pay their mortgage, who has no other options, to take the moral high ground and not do it. The world isn't that straightforward. It's not that simple. You just need to school yourself up on those risks.
I mean,
and to take appropriate advice on it.
I think most sort of your standard like Jack, Jamie or Tom's going to go, oh, self-employed, I get more money. They're just going to think that, aren't
and
they?
And don't make the provision then to think, well, I might need to put some money away the event
that
I get
an unexpected
tax bill.
Oh, well, yeah, that as well. I was thinking long-term.
Long-term. Very sensible for someone of your generation to be thinking about your pension. Well done, Ollie. The other question we get asked a lot in this area is around IR35. So someone will say, I'm inside or outside of IR35. It's a word that gets thrown around quite a lot. And if I talk to either an employee or, a worker or a self-employed person or a company and they go, oh, it's fine, we've done an IR35 assessment. And I go, okay, well, show me the results then. Show me the assessment that you've done. Now, IR35, it's a word that's thrown around a huge amount. It's a piece of tax legislation,
right, okay.
Basically. If someone is inside IR35, mm-hmm. they're considered to be like a payroll worker. We should be deducting tax from that person. If they're outside IR35, they are considered to be off payroll. They deal with their own situation. They are self-employed. And there is a test that you can do, I think it's on the .gov or the HMRC website, where you are taken through a series of questions. You answer the questions in terms of what happens in that relationship, and it will give you a result at the end. You can keep that result on file so that then if there was a challenge by HMRC later on, mm-hmm. you can say, well, look, we did the test, your test, this is what it said. Provided you answer honestly, which is the other thing. When I say, oh, great, someone's outside IR35, can I see the test results? And they'll show me the last page, and I'm like, now show me all the answers. Okay, well, you didn't answer that one correctly, and that one's definitely not right. Very yeah, it's only as good as the information you put into it. And then you'll get an employer who'll wave their IR35 result around like a flag going, we've done it, they're off payroll. However, the employment tribunal doesn't have to follow it. The employment tribunal can do their own assessment. So HMRC and the tribunal have their own separate, essentially, schemes of deciding whether or not someone is employed or not. So you could be in this weird situation where HMRC don't have a problem with it, but a tribunal judge decides that someone is an employer or worker, and you're on the hook for lots of employment-related claims.
Are these two tests remotely similar?
There's lots of overlap, but some of it is quite subjective. So when you talk about level of control... There's quite a lot of grades of grey there rather than black
and white. Uniform tools, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So while the tests are very similar in terms of the questions that might be asked, an employment judge can come to a different conclusion than what HMRC might do. And one doesn't cancel out the other.
No. You can get in trouble with either, can't
which
you?
Which basically means the employer can't win. you can be on the hook either which way, which is why it is so important that we don't just write up crap contracts that we've pulled off the internet, label someone as self-employed and go, we're covered. And I get this question all the time going, I've heard down the pub that if the contract's bang on, I'm good. Can you write me one of these magic contracts? And I go, no.
I cannot do that.
That's not how it works. I could. I can write you a banging contract. Doesn't mean you're not going to get pinged by HMRC or you're not going to get pinged by a tribunal. We've got to go through the steps of doing that test, deciding, do we have mutuality of obligation? What is level of control? Are we requiring that people use their own tools, their own equipment, got their own insurance, responsible for their own training? What is the reality of the situation? Do our determination, keep the evidence, document the reasons why we've made the decision, and then make sure that the contract actually reflects the way that we work.
Real foggy, isn't it? Real foggy, for lack of a better.
Do you know what? It's boring, it's administrative, and it's a really, really dry area of the law. It's bloody dreadful, frankly. I hate doing IR35 determinations.
Is this new legislation stuff going to affect the IR35 process, or is that just going to remain?
So IR35 is the tax stuff. What we might lose is the worker status.
Right, okay.
So that little grey area in the middle where I can go, Ollie, a few hours work next week, gone. It's either full-blown employee or self-employed.
People can still ask people to work for cash, though, without a contract, like, I'm assuming.
We shouldn't be doing
that. And they will.
We shouldn't be doing that.
Like farmhands and stuff, I'm thinking of specifically.
Yeah,
you know?
But this isn't like, it's not just like invisible income. Everything has to be declared. And I get, that's another favourite question. It's a really good response that one of my employers once had, is that someone asked to be paid cash. And they went, yeah, sure. So they get the little brown envelope and they gave it to them. And the employee's like, yes. You know, got an amazing employer. That's it. I'm not going to pay any tax. The employer's declaring it. They're telling him, and they said, we will pay you in cash. We will give you pound notes if you want, but we will be declaring the income to HMRC to say that we have paid you. And the employees then sort of scratching their head going, now what?
And they had to tax the cash? Or was it?
Yeah, so they'll do the deductions from it.
The employee had to do the taxes?
No, so the employer will do it. They will do the deductions and they will pay them in cash. So the employees asked for it and then realised, actually, I might as well have just had it straight into my bank account.
There's no benefit.
So just because someone is getting something in cash does not mean the employer doesn't have an obligation to do the deductions, to do it properly.
Silly employees. Yeah.
It's one of my favourite responses. Yeah, sure, we'll pay you in cash.
After we've deducted,
reported it to HMRC and done everything that we should be doing.
Final question for the employee perspective. We've covered the middle one about kind of the benefits of being fully employed and what have you. What do I do if it's actually my employer refusing to take me on as an employee?
So, as we've said, you know, I'm never going to tell someone that they shouldn't take work. I'm not here to judge someone's situation. You know, if you've got someone who is desperate, it's all the work that they can find. You can, you know, my view would be at least try and leave a paper trail to say to the employer, look, I do feel like this arrangement is more like that of a worker or an employee. However, I'm not the person with the power in the situation, so I will accept your determination. But if I were them, I'd be taking financial advice and looking at what sort of tax or provision for their pension that they need to be putting to one side, because they're not going to be getting those benefits. And also remembering that the employer is going to be taking the attitude that your employment is not protected. So think, actually, how stable is that work? What are the reasons why that company aren't prepared to engage you properly? Is it around saving money, you know, because it's expensive to employ people? Or is it actually because they rip through a workforce and their turnover is really high and they see it as a low-risk way of taking people on? And also remember, the minimum wage doesn't apply to the self-employed.
Not.
It doesn't.
You get paid whatever.
It only applies to workers and employees. So if you are self-employed and you're being paid a day rate or a weekly rate, you're at risk that you're not going to be paid properly either.
Crikey, I didn't know that. I always thought, like, it's just, as I keep saying, it's just synonymous with getting tax loss, getting more money.
Yeah.
Now, clearly a lot more risk to it. Lessons learned. What emergency measures can HR departments take to prevent this happening in future?
So if you have got a workforce that's mixed, that's diverse, so we might have employees, we might have workers, we might have self-employed people. Take our business, for example. We have employees, but then we also can contract with our developers.
We do.
They are an external company that we contract with. They are not our employees. We should be understanding the status of everybody that we pay and understand why we pay them the way that we do and why we have determined that that is their status. So we've got some projects that we might be looking at over the next few months where we might need to engage some freelancers. We might need a bit of additional support around the training programs that we're going to be looking at. Mm-hmm. Those people, if they accept the work, they finish the job, we've no obligation to continue to engage them. They are workers, they are freelancers, they can go off to do whatever their next project is. So we're very clear on why we're engaging people in the way that we are and making sure that the documentation is accurate and up to date. So auditing your workforce, who have we got, what category and why, and is it accurate, is it up to date, or do we need to be changing things?
What happened to this chef? And why?
So it didn't take him on.
Right. Okay.
So the advice that I gave in this situation was it's too fraught with risk.
It's landmines
for the company. Yeah, yeah. And you've also got to remember as well, where you're in a situation where it's a role that's typically quite hard to come by, you know, this person can potentially just walk away. They're self-employed. If they decide I'm not turning up today, you know, it's Friday night, busiest service of the week in the pub. And he says, well, actually, no, I'm not turning in for work. We're not going to be applying disciplinary measures to someone who's self-employed. Where you're in a situation where you are reliant on consistency, where you want to make sure that that individual is secure in their role because they're going to be hard to replace, self-employed is probably not the way to go.
No, you're sort of compromising reliability, aren't you,
yeah,
in that respect? They're not actually part of the business.
No. No, they're not.
No commitment at all. I think we've covered everything. That was a bit quicker than previous ones. But
it's quite a technical one, though. But it's questions that we get regularly. They're really, really common queries. So I think, you know, having gone through that legal test, we talk about workers, employees, self-employed. We've talked about, you know, determination and the risks of it all. You know, we've covered quite a lot. There's a lot in there.
If you are fraught with a mixed sort of workforce, give us a call or what have you, or an email, because we do accommodate for contractors, employees, not workers, because I didn't even know that was a thing before today.
We have a 0 hours contract template in the system.
We can do that.
So we can accommodate everything. But the key is that determination, thinking about that test.
Lovely. Like, comment, subscribe. Cheers.
Until next time, we're your host signing off from HRER. Take care of your HR and may your workplace be disaster-free. Before we go, a big thank you to you for tuning in, and don't forget to subscribe. If you have your own ER stories or suggestions for future episodes, reach out to us at Heroes or on social media, or even HRER@heroes.co.uk. As we navigate the maze of workplace blunders, remember that no organisation is perfect. But by sharing these stories, we can all work towards creating healthier, happier and more productive workplaces.